The one thing that a crisis has really shown is that a crisis is useful. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
It's great to be back with you, Barry, here in the studio. My studio and your studio, respectively. Feels very good.
I social distancing. We're taking the 6 feet thing pretty literally. Yeah, we're six leagues away from each other.
I was going to say, multiply 5,280 by about 120, and that's how many feet we are away from one another.
That's right.
And last I heard, you can't transmit this thing through a microphone, so we're okay. And through the data line, so we're okay. it feels very good. So far, no illness here. No one that we know of. I'm the only person that I know of that has coronavirus is 3 degrees of separation away. A friend of someone I go to church with, and I have not had a recent report on that person. They were on a ventilator in a hospital. That's all I can tell you. So, other than that, we pray that you are all well out there. We continue to say you know from this program, if you listen, that I'm a skeptic on the doom and gloom, but I'm not a skeptic on the virulence of this virus. It's very virulent. It's very dangerous, especially if you fit into certain categories. And please stay safe. That's my advice to you. I still am a skeptic. I'm doing calculations on the presumptive rates of fatality in Ohio. They're much lower than panic monger Dr. Amy Acton has claimed, and they continue to be lower, and the number will drop as more people are tested. And when the final statistics are done, we will find that it was several times more dangerous than the normal flu, but not as dangerous as they're claiming.
And I can tell you one thing it's very less dangerous than, and that is abortion, Chuck.
Way less dangerous.
Because I want to roll right into this morning. Folks, it's Thursday morning. It's April the 2nd as we record this program. And it has been, and I understand from most people's perspectives, this has been a frustrating going on 3 weeks now because of the orders coming out from the state and businesses shutting down and not being able to find certain supplies and goods like toilet paper, which I still don't understand.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
You can find it, you just can't find it in most of the big box stores, but I've found that there are other places where you can find toilet paper and it's not, as rare as hen's teeth. But during all this, I mean, I know that a lot of people are either working from home or they've been reduced in force or let go because their company or their restaurant or others had to shut down because of the way this thing was going. And so, on the face of it, Chuck, all of these decisions that are being made by our state actors and at the federal level, the Trump administration with their briefings with Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx and all the other folks, the Surgeon General and everybody else, is all being done, at least on the surface of it, as a means of trying to reduce the spread of this virus, reduce the impact upon people, because as you mentioned, yes, this thing is deadly. It is a pandemic. I'm not going to discount that either. I really would not want to have this foisted upon myself or my family or people and friends that I love like you, or of anybody else for that matter, because I've had some serious bronchitis. I've had pneumonia. I've had these kind of things before where your lungs fill up and you feel like you can't breathe. And that's what I understand COVID's like. But as you mentioned, it really pales in comparison the amount of infections and deaths that we're going to get from this particular disease versus the amount of pain and suffering and death that we see daily in this state and in this country from the continued promotion, support, and looking the other way on aborting defenseless human unborn babies. And those two things have kind of run headlong into each other, Chuck. It's in a interesting, you know, coming together of circumstances. Because and you mentioned Dr. Amy Acton, who is the director of the Ohio Department of Health, and whether you love her, hate her, believe that you should be snacking with Acton at 2 o'clock in the afternoon every day, or that you're just watching your daily dose of 2 o'clock tyranny. You know, the point is that she's become a major figurehead for this whole issue. And just, you know, a little bit of her background. You know, before Mike DeWine picked her to be his director of the Department of Health, she was a she worked with the Columbus Foundation, which is a major granting organization. And, you know, most of the major metropolitan areas around the state and around the country have these foundations where the big money folks, the corporate titans, et cetera, plant some of their money and have this foundation direct who gets some of these resources, you know, whether it goes to art or it goes to, like, children's welfare or things of that nature. But Amy Acton, when she worked for the Columbus Foundation, busily wrote grants for groups like old Planned Parenthood, Chuck, and NARAL, the
National Abortion
the Ohio Rights. Chapter yeah. of the National Abortion Rights Action League. So, you know, given the fact that Mike DeWine, who campaigned on and who historically has claimed to be pro-life, when he picked Amy Acton, it was with some trepidation that people looked at it like, wait a minute, you know, personnel is policy. And so, you know, there was a little bit of this, you know, we're already having trouble. You know, we've had trouble over the number of years trying to get abortion providers shut down because of violations like, you know, killing patients. And I'm not just talking about the babies. I'm talking about the number of the women. We've had case after case of complications from abortions, from where an abortionist has botched a procedure and a woman's either bled to death or gotten a secondary infection, etc., you know, going into shock, whatever. And you know, even one where abortionist Martin Haskell basically did an abortion on a woman who was high on drugs, which is an absolute legal no-no in the state of Ohio to start with, because you can't give informed consent if you're not in your right mind. But every one of these times, the facilities just kind of figure out some loophole way of legally running the traps, and they get out of it, even to the point where when Haskell's license was revoked by the state, it didn't take more than 2 weeks for him to turn around, create a new LLC, a holding company for his abortion facility, change its name a little bit, and then go back to the state, and they reissued him a license. Even after taking him all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court and fighting for 4 years to take it away from him. So you have to say that, you know, we're very suspicious about the new director of the Department of Health now being the one who, because it's the DOH who basically brings all the suits against the abortion providers for either their violations of state laws and administrative code standards, or, you know, they're having to surrender their facility licensure because it's the Department of Health that gives them facility licensure. So basically, you know, here's the deal going on that when this whole thing started, you know, when we started getting the daily doses of Dr. Acton and the governor and, you know, the cast of thousands, maybe John Houston, the lieutenant governor, or Frank LaRose, the secretary of state. And we're going to talk about his role here in a little bit, Chuck. I know that you're chomping at the bit on that.
I am, baby.
I know you are, but we'll talk about him in a couple minutes.
Yep.
But during this whole thing, back on the 17th of March, Dr. Acton put forward, with the governor, obviously, you know, these orders don't come straight from the Department of Health. They come from the governor's office, and they use the Department of Health as the vehicle because under 3701.13 of the Ohio Revised Code, which is a section number, during a health emergency, the director of the Department of Health is given all this authority to do pretty much anything they feel like doing in order to try to preserve the public health and to combat a, you know, disease or infection or bioterrorism event. And we've been talking to our legislators because the wording of that particular section of code is fairly amorphous and somewhat Swiss cheese-like, and so we want to see if we can't tighten that down after we get through all this panic to keep it from being an excuse for, you know, being able to, you know, declare martial law through the auspices of an agency without ever having to declare martial law, which is what we think we're in, you know, we're about to see here. I think from what I've heard, Chuck, either today or before the end of the week, we might get some new edicts from the governor that are going to make what the restrictions and the prohibitions that have already been put in place look like child's play. So, and again, all in the sense of we're trying to save lives, you know, so by wrecking others. I'm showing my colors.
Yes,
I'm honestly not a big fan of all the things that Mike DeWine has done.
No,
but I want to talk about that a little bit later too, because right. There are some people who are big fans of that, and it's not really surprising who they are. So back around on the 17th, an order was issued by the state that basically said that surgeries that are considered elective, that means that they are not for the purpose of immediately saving someone's life, and they're not for the purpose of immediately stopping the progression of a major disease, are considered to be postponed until further notice. In other words, they understand that, like, the ambulatory surgical facilities, the eye clinics, the joint replacements, all of these other types of surgery, oral surgeries, you know, to, like, you know, do teeth removals or things of that nature, are not absolutely vitally necessary at this point in time in our health crisis, and actually, in many senses, serve to consume what has become probably a more valuable commodity than toilet paper in both in Ohio and nationally, and that is what's called PPE, or personal protective equipment. That is the N95, the face masks, the breathing masks, the face shields, the sanitary gloves, and, well, ventilators as well, Chuck, for when people do get, a horribly nasty case of COVID that requires intensive care and hospitalization in order to help them breathe. They realize that, well, first of all, these elective surgeries need to be postponed for a while until we get through this crisis so that we can conserve this personal protective equipment that is so desperately needed because, well, depending on who you listen to, Chuck, either we are in a situation where we have an absolute shortage on all of this stuff worldwide, or we have plenty of it. It's just being stockpiled in places and by groups that have not been good team players, you know, in the national crisis, and are trying to profit and price gouge in order to get more greed out of this emergency situation. You hear 36 million face masks were hidden away, in this one place and this, you know, this other place, and New York is setting on. There's a picture I saw this online, a picture like in a holding facility in these big cages, and it's just stacked with thousands of ventilators, of these, you know, small yellow ventilator portable machines that are sitting in New York that are not being distributed out to the hospitals and other places. And it's like, okay, so yeah, there's mismanagement bureaucracy that's causing some of this stuff. It's sort of like when we see in these foreign countries, when we send aid to these foreign countries and it sits on the docks or it's in a warehouse, or in the case of Puerto Rico, some officials stockpile it and hide it away so that they can turn around and sell it to make profit on
it. Sell it later, yep. Exactly.
And I know I'm going all over the boards, but follow with me, folks. So on the 17th, that order came out. It was effective on the next day, the 18th, for all non-essential surgeries, what we call elective surgeries, to be halted. Well, guess what, Chuck? I had to cancel, and I'm still in the process of waiting to figure out when to reschedule a tooth extraction for my 80-year-old mother, who needs to get a partial plate at dentures, because that's considered elective surgery. So, you know, she's waiting on that to happen so she can get all this other stuff done. Other people had to cancel joint replacements. And honestly, Chuck, if you've ever had a joint that needed replaced, I haven't, thank God. I probably may have before I, you know, end my days on this planet. But I've understood that it's extremely painful and, you know, uncomfortable to have a joint that's going bad and then have to say, well, we have to postpone that surgery in order to replace that joint, and we don't know when we're going to reschedule it because of this health emergency. You're asking a lot of people who have painful and possibly debilitating joint deterioration to have to just kind of stay put and grit it out. But, again, it's to the point of trying to preserve this personal protective equipment and not expose more people to potential exposure to this deadly virus. Well, everybody complied. My chiropractor shut down. I mean, I all these other places shut down. There's a couple of docs in town who, you know, they don't do surgeries, but they do other things that use personal protective. Their offices are closed because they're complying. They're jumping on board. They're becoming a team player with this whole idea of, you know, let's redirect the gloves, the face masks, the ventilators, the personal protective equipment over to the hospitals who are on the front lines when people are showing up needing in emergency care, needing to go to the ICU because the COVID virus has filled their lungs up with gunk and they can't breathe
right
on their own.
Yep.
So, you know, and let's protect the healthcare workers, the doctors, the nurses, the physician's assistants, and everybody else, the lab workers, everybody else who has to like be exposed to this as a consequence of their employment, which is now vital in this environment. Let's make sure that they're protected as much as possible. Well, everybody got on board with that, Chuck.
Yeah.
Except one industry, and that was the abortion providers. The Planned Parenthood and the groups like Preterm and Women's Med Center and Capital Care Network and the Columbus Women's Center, those folks basically said, doesn't apply to us because in our world. And I get where the pro-abortion groups and the pro-LGBT groups lock arms together on this, because abortion providers self-identify as lifesavers. They self-identify as cutting a baby out of a woman and cutting it into pieces and ripping it to shreds with suction and yanking it out and taking that life is essential. In their mind, in their world, they self-identify as healers. I don't think anybody else objectively would call them
that,
or would be able to identify them as such because of what they do.
Apparently,
they're removing a bunion; they're taking a human life intentionally.
They have no sense of irony, obviously.
No, but they have a very well defined and sharp sense of greed.
Oh, absolutely.
So this order came down effective on March 18th. Okay, so did Preterm, did Haskell's Women's Med Center in Dayton, did Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio or the Northeast Ohio branches, did they all shut their doors or basically say, well, we can do mammograms and pap screens and things of that nature, and we can provide you your birth control, but we just can't kill your baby? Oh, no, Chuck.
No.
They basically thumbed their nose and basically said full out, we're not going to comply with the order because we don't think it should apply to us. Okay, fine, great. Okay, you know, you don't think it will apply. Well, there's ways you go about doing that. But they kept going and they kept basically thumbing their nose. And Chuck, I'm just going to be quite honest. Ohio has had the distinction of being the first state in the country to get out in front on a lot of the stuff surrounding this outbreak of this virus, of COVID-19, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later with the governor. But we're also the first state who came out and, you know, when we issued this order regarding the non-elective medical procedures, to have the abortion industry basically say, we're not going to comply. And then on Friday of that week, on the 20th, in the late afternoon hours, our Attorney General in Ohio, Dave Yost, who from Delaware, issued a letter to a couple of the providers, the most egregious ones, Preterm up in Cleveland, which is the private provider, and then Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio, which is the nonprofit provider. Planned Parenthood, you know, likes to parade around like they're a nonprofit. Ha ha ha.
Right.
Uh-huh. So they can get lots of government grants. To the tune of, you know, what is it, $600 million right now that they get annually from the federal government, or from our tax dollars, and then money that they get, $2-4 million for a year from the state, here, there, and yonder on various things. But so he sent this letter out, and it was called a cease and desist letter, basically saying, this order does apply to your practices. It applies to what you're doing. And we are telling you that because the director has the power under this health emergency in that section of the code, 3701.13, that I referred to, that she can order, and we can enforce against you the carrying out of shutting your that part of your operation down. Now, you know, in a perfect world, Chuck, we would have had this shutting down abortions entirely. But I want to make sure that people are fully informed and aware that this order, nor did the cease and desist letter that Yost sent out, have that effect. Although, if you listen to the abortion providers and how they're moaning and groaning about it, you would think that it did. It had nothing to do with chemical abortion procedures. So if they want to bring a woman in and start her on the two-dose regimen of mifepristone, RU-46, and then misoprostol, which is the second drug that's given within like 48 hours of the first drug, they can continue to kill babies with chemicals. They just cannot do any surgical removals of babies from a woman. They can't go in and they can't do a D&E or a DNX or other types of procedures where they invasively, you know, go into the woman's uterus to evacuate, tear apart,
right,
shred, and then suction out, vacuum out the dead baby's parts. They can't do that under this order. But you would think that basically, according to them, they were basically told that they can't, that abortions are illegal on the face of it. That's not what the order said. That's not what the cease and desist order, clarified. So, sadly enough, it only affected surgical procedures. And the administration of these chemicals is not a surgical procedure, sadly enough. We've been trying for years to get it all lumped together so that we can just go at it at the same time. But as we've seen, you know, as we're trying to get licenses pulled from some of these facilities that are killing babies and sometimes injuring and killing women, oftentimes, like in Columbus, they switch from being a surgical provider to being a chemical-only provider. And so women can go in, do a quick little run through, sign a couple of pieces of paper, and then they're given a dose of this RU-46 that they pop in their mouth while they're there, and then, you know, given a prescription to get the other thing where they, a couple days later, they can take it because the other drug, the RU-46 basically toxifies the environment.
Right.
It basically makes it unable to continue to sustain life inside the womb.
It poisons the child, essentially.
Effectively, yeah. Poisoning the baby.
Yeah.
But the misoprostol, the second drug, is the one that actually forces the baby's body out of the woman's system. Okay?
Yeah.
So that's what it does. So the first one kills the baby, the second one evacuates the baby, but they do it all by chemical and not by surgical. They can still do this, even under these orders, even though it's considered elective. It's not an elective surgery. It's actually elective pharmacy is what it really gets down to. So on the 20th, on Friday, he wrote this order, the cease and desist, and said, listen, it applies to you, and we're going to enforce it against you if you keep going. Well, Saturday was a land office business for all abortion providers. Our pro-life groups have folks who do sidewalk counseling and who keep an eye on the clinics, and every one of them was sending in photographs and videos of cars coming in and out of these places, extra doctor. I mean, they had more staff in there the day after he said that they couldn't do them than they've ever had before. Okay? Absolutely disobeying the order. Absolutely, you know, thumbing their nose. This continued on through the weekend and into this last week. Okay? So the week, that'd be the 23rd. It was still going on. And Right to Life Action Coalition and our member groups were screaming bloody murder. We were calling the governor. We were calling the AG. We were going back and forth. We were trying to get them to pay attention to this and fix the problem. Because if you're going to ban my mother from getting oral surgery and other people from getting hip and joint replacements, you certainly, by golly, better well keep these guys from killing defenseless babies through surgical means under this health emergency. But remember, we've got a director of the Department of Health who used to write grants to give money to these type of groups, to Planned Parenthood, to others. So there wasn't a whole lot coming out about it. And, of course, during that week, the media, because they like a story, they, if it bleeds, it leads. They're they're seeing some blood in the water on this one against these Republicans. Basically started asking them some serious questions about this thing. And both Director Acton and, I have to say it, pro-life Governor Mike DeWine dodged and weaved like a professional prize fighter who's in a fight that he realizes he's outclassed in, and he's just trying not to get hit.
That's right. He's running without turning his back. So that's what she's doing.
Yeah, without turning tail and climbing out of the ring.
Yep.
Dodge, weave, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. They didn't do the sting like a bee part. They were just flitting like a butterfly, trying to avoid getting hit.
Yeah.
It was fairly disheartening on our end of it, because it's like, wait a minute. This guy parades around as he's pro-life and he's 100% for the babies, etc. And then he picks a former Obama organizer who writes grants for abortion providers to be the director of the Department of Health, who then issues an order. And then once the order actually impinges or impacts upon abortion, goes radio silent on whether or not it should be enforced that way. And of course, the state, thank God, at least on the face of it, Dave Yost is pro-life. I'm not going to doubt it. He said he's pro-life and he's trying to do what he can do, because he represents, as the Attorney General, he represents the executive branch of government, which means his client is the Ohio Department of Health. And so whatever his client wants him to do as the attorney, he's going to do it. So ultimately, there had to have been a reason why the governor and the department basically directed Yost to write a cease and desist letter, which he did. Well, finally, about, was it Wednesday or Thursday of last week, it was finally announced that after all this pressure, that the Department of Health was going to go ahead and send investigators to investigate whether or not these clinics are following the order. Well, that was Friday. That was last Friday they announced that they were going to do this. On Monday of this week, Chuck, on the 30th of March, the ACLU, as the attorneys for, along with private attorneys, for Planned Parenthood and these abortion-providing clinics in Ohio, filed an emergency appeal or a motion with the federal U.S. District Court, basically claiming that enforcement of the order of March the 18th by the Department of Health against them is tantamount to a total ban on abortion and thus is unconstitutional under Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey's auspices of the federal court rulings. They filed that like about 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon. Chuck, it was about 7 o'clock in the evening that Judge Barrett, who has been on the federal bench since being appointed, I think, by Bill Clinton, and who was formerly the legal counsel for Planned Parenthood, issued a stay against the state enforcing the order. It took him less than 3 hours, Chuck. I mean, honestly, I've seen some of these briefs. I've seen the legal arguments. You couldn't have gotten through the briefs and made a merit decision on this in that length of time. This was just a knee jerk. Now, I've talked about this before on the program, Chuck. Michael Barrett is the federal judge who, for some reason, must have a good luck charm in his pocket. Because every time that there's a case coming from Ohio restriction on abortion, somehow, magically, in a random selection process, which is how these cases are assigned at the federal court level, they are randomly assigned. You get case number X, and then they go, okay, well, this goes to, and then they do the lottery thing. Oh, this judge gets it. Every last case for the last 5 or 6 years on abortion coming out of the state of Ohio on regulating and restricting abortion, Judge Michael Barrett has been the lucky duck who has pulled and is the presiding judge on every one of those cases. Every last stinking one of those cases.
The fix isn't in, is it?
Lottery numbers? Because, my goodness, I want to hit the lottery.
I think the only way
we'll do it is if Mike Barrett picks the numbers.
Look, it becomes obvious after a while that the fix is in. They don't pick these randomly. They're assigning cases based on the personality of the judge and the outcome that they want. Flat out, that this is what's happening.
Right, and it's what happened. So basically, Monday night, he issues his ruling that he's putting a temporary hold or restraining order on the enforcement of the department's action, and by extension, the Attorney General's cease and desist letter, for at least 2 weeks. Well, Chuck, 2 weeks, oh, well, we could be lifting that order in 2 weeks, and therefore it's moot. And, of course, I'm sure that if they continue to extend the order, then he'd come back and say, well, no, I'm going to permanently enjoin it now. With these things, that's what happens. He gets a temporary restraining order when it gets ready to go into effect, which holds it for a little while both sides brief in motion and do all their arguments before the court, for him to ultimately come out and say, no, I'm going to make it a permanent injunction against this, which is what he's done on every case. And then ultimately it goes up to the appellate court level, which in Ohio we sit in the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals zone. It's us, Michigan, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Those are the 4 states that are in the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals.
Right.
Are their jurisdiction. Well, this ruling came out Monday night. On Tuesday, our Right to Life Action Coalition groups went ballistic, okay? We pounded the AG. We pounded the governor's office. So it's like, you need to appeal this.
Get on top of this. ASAP. Yeah.
Well, yesterday afternoon, Attorney General Dave Yost filed a motion with the U.S. 6th Circuit Court of Appeals asking for them to issue a stay against Barrett's temporary restraining order, i.e., block him from freezing us up from enforcing this, and appealing his ruling on it, and basically saying that you issue the stay while the ruling is being reviewed by the circuit. Now, this was late last night. So this morning, I mean, I was busy texting and everything last night and writing copy and press releases and everything else for our groups at the Right to Life Action Coalition. We don't have any new information right now whether or not the 6th is going to issue the stay against Barrett's orders, but we hope that he will, and whether or not they're going to basically overrule it and say that, yes, this order, which every other medical provider and ambulatory surgical facility in the state of Ohio has complied with, does indeed apply to the abortion providers. And I can't take credit for this, but somebody came out and said, listen, if abortion providers say that that abortion is a woman's choice, then it can't be a necessary emergency procedure. It's always elective, if that's the case. And I thought, you know what? He's got a good point there, or she has a good point there, that, yes, they've spent so long talking about a woman's right to choose, that it's coming back around on them, because what they're talking about is a procedure that's chosen, not a procedure that's necessary or is an emergency that has to be dealt with by scheduling and walking into an abortion facility.
Abortion is not health care.
It is not health care.
Just real quick, I'm going to make a comment after this, but I want to go to the Bible for a minute.
Oh, please do.
Yes. Since we are a biblically based program, I think we should look at the Bible for guidance. And gosh, what do you know? Leviticus 19:15. Now, please don't dive into the thing and say, well, that's the law, and you know, nobody has to follow the law anymore. Of course, we still have to follow the law. The whole point is, with Christ, we do have to try to follow the law, but we can't do it. That's the point. But this part would be very easy to follow. Again, Leviticus 19:15. You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor. And 16 goes on and says, you shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Well, who's your closest neighbor? If you are a pregnant woman, it is the young person who is growing rapidly inside you.
Yep.
Anybody who wants to say God doesn't care about abortion, guess what? There it is right there. Now, Barry, we've talked on this program. My opinion is that abortion is considered to be a sacrament to the religion of self, the worship of self. Yes. And career, and not only that, but also of the state. And this kind of goes along with that. These people are acting as if this is a First Amendment right. Now, at the same time, the state has exempted churches, most of whom are complying. From, you know, my church, Providence Presbyterian Church in Pataskala, Ohio, we're doing online services at 11 o'clock on Sunday, and they are live, both on Facebook and on YouTube. There are about 4 of us in the church while we do this. So we're plenty far distance apart. The pastor's there. I'm there running the electronics. The sound man is there running the sound to make sure that the feeds are okay. And usually there's somebody in the deacon's office doing this or that or another thing. But what we are seeing in other states, Florida arrested Rodney Howard Brown for holding services in his church. I don't know if you know anything about Rodney Howard Brown. We won't go into that. He's a prosperity gospel guy.
Yes.
He's, in my opinion, heretical. But nonetheless, he has the right to hold a church service and worship in the way that suits his spirituality. And I think he has the right to hold services if he so desires, and as long as people are being smart about it. But no, they've arrested him and put him in jail, which is essentially an incubator. Let's not kid ourselves. In states like California, they're letting felons go, at the meantime threatening to arrest pastors for holding church services. And Mario Cuomo has basically come out and said, not only will we shut you down if you have a church service, we will permanently shut you down. You will not be able to reopen as a church. Now, Barry, does he have the legal right to do that? Do we not have a First Amendment issue? And remember,
there is definitely a First Amendment issue when you're talking about the church, because the church is a completely separate jurisdiction.
Exactly. The church is the jurisdiction of Christ. Does that mean that the church can do things that disobey the law? No, but there is no law. This again, as we've talked in shows prior to this, this is a power grab. This is an attempt to usurp authority. In some cases, is it warranted if people are sitting shoulder to shoulder in a crowded auditorium? If Joel Osteen was holding, had his building open and it was had 11,000 people in it, would that probably be stupid? Yeah, that would probably be stupid. And luckily, most people recognize that, especially, for instance, in congregations that have significantly older members or members who are sick. They shouldn't be in the building. They shouldn't be having contact with one another. They should be home, sheltering in place, and watching this service live on electronic media, which, thank God, we live in an era when we can do that. You know, in 1918 and 19, you couldn't just shut a church down and have everybody go home and listen to it on the radio. Radio was so new that almost nobody had it, and if you did have it, it would have to be in Morse code.
Right.
So we live in a wonderful era. This is a sacramental practice at this point, in which case the sacrament of abortion is more important than the sacrament, than the actual worship service, which God has required of his people, that we come in and pay homage to him, and he asks us to do it to respect the Lord's Day. Now, is there a biblical admonition that we have to be in a church on Sunday? No, there isn't. I think we're not required to do that. But we are required to pay homage to God and give honor to him one day a week. And in Christianity, we've been doing it on the first day, which is Resurrection Day, since the resurrection of Christ. Essentially, since the church was established, which was, you know, essentially Pentecost. But
right.
we've been doing it. There were people that were gathering together on the first day before that. And we've been doing it that way. And the fact is that we have a fundamental right to do that. In fact, rights come from God. And as we just heard in the Leviticus passage, there's no right to pervert justice. There's no right to kill other people. There's no right to interfere with people's practice of their Christianity. And so we have a major problem brewing here. The problem is that because in certain areas of the country, like the Northeast, the first thing Massachusetts did was exempt abortion. Why? Was it necessary for health? Of course not.
No, of course not.
Because at least 50% of the patients die in an abortion. At least 50%. Sometimes it's higher than that, because let's face it, abortion is occasionally a fatal for the mother as well as for the infant. I'm acquainted with a case in Ohio many years ago. My wife had a friend, and I didn't put this together for years, who had to be rushed into the hospital because, she had to have a dilation and curettage. And I said, okay, what was wrong? Oh, she had all this. She had bleeding and blah, 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 blah. And I put two and two together later, and I said, oh, she had a botched abortion. And that's exactly what happened after I sort of pumped and wheedled and cajoled. That's what her friend had a botched abortion that almost killed her. Very close.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing does happen. And this was, by the way, not during the supposed bad old days when it was done, when it was back alley. This was done in a Planned Parenthood clinic. So let's not kid ourselves that somehow legalization made it safe. As Bill Clinton used to say, I always used to laugh, safe, legal, and rare.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that stupid mantra?
I remember, and I remember that they've now dropped the rare
part. Rare part, yeah.
And they've actually dropped the safe part. Now they're just talking about it being legal, and they're trying to say it's health care.
Yeah, exactly. Abortion, folks, is not health care. Are there cases where the baby dies when the mother's being treated and her life's being saved? Yeah, that does happen. That's not an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
That is not an abortion. That is health care. Attempting to save the life of the mother and the baby does not survive. That nothing can be done about that.
Sure.
You know, we live in it. God is in control of life and death, and currently, right now, but there are miraculous things being done to save the life of both mother and child.
And absolutely are.
And it's not being done in abortion clinics.
No, not even remotely.
Not even remotely.
And again, this is a situation where it's more about their greed than it is about care. Because if they had care, they'd be like, yeah, we're going to follow the order. We're going to send the PPE, the personal protective equipment that we have, over to the hospitals who are on the front lines fighting this. Now, Chuck, most people, if you think about abortion providers, would think that, okay, well, they're talking about masks and gloves, right?
Yeah.
Not quite so fast, because there's another little piece in Ohio law that an ambulatory surgical facility, which is what these abortion providers have to be licensed under,
right?
One of their requirements is that they have to have ventilators.
Ventilators, yeah, for emergency oxygen,
right? But Chuck,
administration.
What basically Planned Parenthood is saying is they are wanting to hold on to this personal protective equipment that could save the lives of people who come down with this virus, because they want to use it to take the lives of unborn children. Because taking the life of an unborn child for them is a profit center. Now, it's funny how hard they're arguing this, Chuck, and this struck me just the other day. It's funny how hard they're arguing this, and you know, and getting states like the liberal states like Massachusetts to give them a free pass, but other states, and again, Ohio started this ball rolling, but then Texas jumped on board, and they've gone even farther than we have. They've actually already gone through their court system, and they've gotten it locked down. Iowa's doing it. Oklahoma's doing it. There are about seven other states that are now jumping on board, saying, "Yeah, we're going to shut you guys down from doing surgical abortions while this health crisis is going on, because it is ridiculous and it is a waste of this protective equipment." Well, at least in Ohio, you know, they have to have ventilators on hand. Now, the director of the Department of Health just issued an order, I think it was maybe on Monday or Tuesday, basically saying by Wednesday afternoon, every medical facility in the state had to report if they had ventilators and how many they had on hand. I want to see the copy of that report, because I want to see if all seven of Ohio's abortion providers actually volunteer that they are following the law.
Well, listen, if they're given a tacit pass, it's because the Ohio Department of Health let them.
Exactly.
And that means that Amy Acton, who is the head of the Department of Health and a pro-abort, let them.
Mm-hmm.
And the governor, by doing nothing, let her basically take the reins, which is what I've been saying all along. He is allowing this pro-abort, pro-Obama, essentially radical activist to be in charge of Ohio's government.
Yeah, basically that's what it got down to. Now, you know, we hope that as we get done with the court situations, you know, you've got this whole situation in hand, you know, that they are going to be dealt with, you know, according to the measure that they've met out with. If they want to be considered health care, then they need to be able to, then they need to follow all the rules and regulations that every other healthcare provider, which means they have to have current, accurate licensing. They have to have the minimum safety standards. They have to have, they have to follow all the rules regarding the equipment that they have. They have to do every, if the abortion providers want to be considered healthcare providers, then they better darn well get ready to have that addressed.
They better. Yeah. Look, here's the bad part. When if some of this turns out to be overhyped and blah blah blah, you know, oh well, you know, we had to go with what we had to go with, and you know, okay, some of that's understandable. There will be no consequences. No one will have to pay any price. Those who basically knew, like for instance, Amy Acton has been operating on this this model out of England. That is, yes, that is now essentially debunked, as we pointed out last week. The people who wrote the reporter saying, yeah, we were far, and that now we're getting word that the CDC is saying at least 25% of people who have had the coronavirus don't know it, have no symptoms, are merely carriers. 25%, Barry. The numbers are staggering when you start thinking about the number of people they said were going to be infected. Well, if 25% of them are never going to have the symptoms, then what? How do we work that into the calculation? What does that do? Statistically, as I talked about last week, statistically, it
knocks, that flattens the curve, doesn't it, Chuck?
It knocks the pins out of all the calculations. So death rate, infection rate, all that. It knocks the pins out. It means that the numbers are meaningless. Mm-hmm. They're what we used to call a WAG, and I'm not going to tell you what, a wild blank guess. And I can tell you, as a former lab technician, sometimes you had to do a WAG. You just did a wild guess on, okay, where do we think that we are on the titer in this? You know, if you're trying to find an unknown, what do you think the concentration is? Have no idea. You guess,
yeah.
And if you're wrong, then you set up the experiment and do it again, or the analysis. Usually, not an experiment, yeah, but an analysis. You know that I've done that many times. Okay, what do you think it is? What is it? We don't know. What do you think it is? Maybe in this range. Okay, fine, we'll go with that. That's exactly where we are. I don't want to get too much into that because we got other stuff we need to do in this time frame. But the fact is that no one's ever going to be called to account. Now, the Democrats are going to try to turn Obama's response into another impeachment process. That's already underway.
Wait a minute. You mean not Obama's response?
Trump's response. Ignore.
I was going to say, don't forget, we are now in 2020.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Ignoring Obama's response to his coronavirus outbreak, which was which was to do nothing for like 6 months, and then a bunch of people died, and then they took some tiny little steps. And you know, Biden calling Trump irresponsible for his response. Trump's response has been fine. My chiropractor said he's probably 2 weeks late on the travel ban, but other than that, you know, he was a little busy at the time. And they're saying, see, it was the impeachment. It's all his fault. What people don't remember is that during the State of the Union address in January, he talked about the coronavirus. And Nancy Pelosi, who is now critical of him for his response, was busy tearing his speech into shreds. Not listening, saying it was all garbage. Yeah. Meanwhile, Trump's laying out what they're, you know, talking about. We're going to have a response to the coronavirus. And if you don't think so, go back and find a copy of the State of the Union speech. And find a video copy of Nancy Pelosi standing behind him tearing the speech into shreds. And then tell me you're going to do another impeachment based on the coronavirus response. Sorry, folks, right. You don't get to do that. You know, there are other things going on here, though, Barry, that affect us directly here in Ohio besides just the virus problem.
That's true.
I sent you two articles. I don't know if you got the second one or not. One is in the American Thinker, and it says Ohio uses smoke and mirrors on voters. And if you look in your email, you'll have it. And basically their premise is that, well, I'll give you the opening line. The residents of Ohio are getting screwed.
Okay, that's pretty blunt.
Yeah, they have not been informed, and this is true, folks. Out there, listen, please pay attention. They have not been informed that voting day has been moved from June 2nd to April 28th. Go out there and ask people when they think that voting ends, when we have to vote by, and they still think it's June 2nd because that was the original proposal. And the legislature came through and changed it to April 28th. You have to be complete in your voting, and it has to be absentee by April 28th. You probably don't know this. Please. There's no notice from the county to anyone and nothing in the media about it.
Right.
Where is everybody reporting this? They're nowhere. This may be the only place you hear it between that. I'm sure someone will come up with it. But the fact is that when our walk-in voting day was postponed on March 17th, probably illegally, I'll tell you that right out front. The way that was done was basically a judge issued an order that said no, voting has to continue. And DeWine went to four members of the Supreme Court who voted over the phone that his postponement of the election could take place.
Yeah.
That is, to say the least, funky. Probably illegal. Nobody is doing anything about it. Now, the fact is that my sister-in-law called the county Board of Elections and said, how come you haven't sent out absentee ballot applications to everyone in the county who hasn't voted? Mm-hmm. Do you know what the response was? We want to. We're enjoined by law from doing it.
Yeah.
Now, Frank LaRose, actually, the Ohio Secretary of State, is not happy, near as I can tell from what is on the Secretary of State's website, is not happy about this. He wants it done differently. And I know you said something pre-show that you had something about LaRose as well. But there's another article in the American Spectator, and I would suggest you go out and using COVID-19 to kill vote security. What this is about, this article is all about, is attempts to go over to electronic voting. Folks, if you want to lose your right to vote and have your vote stolen, electronic voting is absolutely the way to go. So if you're aching to have your voice wiped out, electronic voting. Mail voting is bad enough. Here's the deal. It is so easy to defraud the system through mail voting that we should have stuck with that June 2nd date and had walk-in voting. But the fact is that what we have going on is the state legislature is doing it this way, and there's a good reason for it from their perspective. What is it, Barry? What, in your opinion? I'll tell you mine.
Ask the question again.
Why is the state legislature doing it this way?
Oh, well, it's simple. It's incumbent protection program.
Bingo. It's incumbent protection. All the challengers. I live in a district and where there's a strong challenge to an incumbent who, by the way, is an appointee, and he's a terrible representative. He's awful, but he will toe the mark of leadership in the House, in the Ohio House of Representatives, and the fact is that he's being squeezed out because nobody knows they're supposed to vote by April 28th. So therefore, the only people who have already voted are the people who always do absentee ballots. You know, so many of them are away out of town for the winter, for instance. They go to Florida, they go to Arizona, they go to Texas to be in the warm during the winter, and they vote absentee and come back, you know, during the summer, during the warm months. Those are the people who have voted. Everybody else, nobody has any idea, no clue whatsoever, that they have to complete their voting by April 28th. And they're essentially enjoining the state boards of or the county boards of education from really getting any useful information out. The fact is, the only thing I'm getting is thinly veiled, and I know you got one of these too, thinly veiled campaign propaganda pieces about the COVID-19 virus from state representatives who are under pressure, who are under incumbency pressure from strong challenges. So the Ohio Republican Party is sending out these franked pieces of telling us all what we already know. If you have a radio or a television on, how to deal with the virus. But it's thinly veiled propaganda campaign pieces with the picture of course, the candidate and his family and their dog and everything on the front. So the fact is, one of the reasons this is going on, ladies and gentlemen, is because you're not angry and you're not out there demanding that this be fixed.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to go to your state representative and your state senator's websites and send them a communication and say, we demand that this election fraud be fixed, because this is a fraud. It's a fraud perpetrated by the state with the help of the governor. Now, I will give the governor credit. This is not the system he wanted. He wanted to do the June 2nd walk-in vote. And barring that, he wanted absentee ballots sent out, and the legislature kiboshed that. So we need, folks, please, I'm begging you. This is election fraud perpetrated by our state representatives to protect the incumbents in their seats.
Well, the other part about that, Chuck, is that if you think about it, when the governor and the secretary of state, quote unquote, postponed the election and then and issued confusing orders to the county boards of elections, and it was going to court and it looked like they were going to lose after they thought they were going to win, that's when they had the Department of Health shut down all the polling places.
Right.
But the point is, Chuck, the one thing that it didn't do was freeze or invalidate absentee votes that had already been cast prior to that Monday afternoon. Chuck, I've been around campaigns and politics for decades. The people who vote early most likely are political types who are usually party regulars.
Exactly.
The county central committee folks, the county party chairs, the big money donors, the folks that the incumbents use to bank votes early. Well, think about this, ladies and gentlemen. If you're now saying that, okay, we're not going to have an in-person voting, and everybody else has to apply to get an absentee ballot who normally don't, and you've only got a month to do so, and we're not going to give you notice, and we're not going to actually just send you a ballot. Well, Chuck, who does that favor who's already got votes in the can?
Incumbents.
Thank you much.
Yeah. I hate to do this. We're out of time because this is an important topic.
Well, we'll probably revisit it again over the next couple of weeks as we're getting closer to that 28th deadline.
As we come to an end, please contact your state senator, your state representative, and the governor, and Frank LaRose, the secretary of state, and your local board of elections. First of all, get your ballot. Apply for your absentee ballot. Get it and vote it. Thumb your nose at these guys. Give them what for? Because as this article started out, The residents of Ohio are getting screwed. And that's exactly what's happening. Okay, that being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.